The views expressed on the following broadcasts do not necessarily reflect those of KHLT, Take 12 Radio, or our affiliates. The opinions on this show should not be considered as medical, psychological, or professional advice and are those of the host, co-host, and guest. Take 12 Radio and KHLT Recovery Broadcasting are not affiliated with any particular 12-step fellowship.
One day at a time with its failures and fears. Portion of pain and burden of care, we must meet.
Welcome to Walking Through the Language of the Heart, a journey into the grapevine writings of Alcoholics Anonymous co-founder Bill W. And now, here are your co-hosts, Chris S. and the Monty Man.
Well, good day, everyone. Morning, noon, or night, whenever you're tuning in. Welcome to another episode of Walking Through the Language of the Heart. And as always, Chris S. is with us. Hey, Chris.
What's happening, Monty?
We listeners, I apologize for last week. We weren't here. I was stuck in traffic. Which reminds me, you know the group Traffic?
I do.
Their song, "Low Spark of the High Heel Boys."
Great album.
Man, what an incredible piece of music. I don't know where that came from. I just had to shoot that out there, man.
Yeah, that was Dave Mason and Steve Winwood and a whole bunch of really, wow, really good musicians.
Yeah, those guys were absolutely amazing. Anyway, don't know where that came out of the left field there, but welcome everybody. What are we doing this week, bud?
Well, Monty, we're clipping along here. We're on part three, which is 1958 to 1970. We're on page 265. We're about two-thirds of the way through the book. And this article was written in January of 1962, and it's called This Matter of Fear. Mm. So I'm really looking forward to this. Now, just to set the stage a little bit, you know there's a fear inventory in the fourth step.
Yes.
They ask us to identify the fear, ask why we have it, then contemplate that, isn't it because self-reliance has failed us, and all of the inventory work that's wrapped around fear. Now, over the years, I've started to see anxiety as what he's talking about. Now, obviously, he's talking about fear.
Yeah.
Right. But how fear manifested in me was mainly in anxiety. Mm-hmm. I just didn't want to be where I was supposed to be doing what I wanted to be doing. And the fabric of my existence was shot through with that, and it created chains of circumstances that were not in my best interest. And so when I approach this, when I approach fear, you know, when I'm working the steps with somebody, I'll explain to them that one of the manifestations of fear is anxiety, what we would know today as anxiety. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, I never really experienced it until years ago when I was flying out to the Florida Keys to cover the 12-step music fest when we had that going on. And it was to be my first trip out there, and I was so excited and pumped, and something came over me. I couldn't go, Chris. And it was, I had to send somebody. I had to send one of the guys that was helping me out. And he went, but it was so powerful, it was paralyzing. I was in panic, my heart was racing, and as soon as I knew I didn't have to go, I was okay. You know, but I'd never experienced anxiety like that before. And that's what my doctor said, you had an anxiety attack.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
So I've had two in my life. I've had two full-blown anxiety attacks, and I thought I was going to die.
Yeah.
Do you know that we end up in the ERs, alcoholics end up in the ERs all the time with those anxiety attacks, and we're clutching our heart, and and the ER staff comes up and puts their instruments on us and go, there's nothing wrong with
right,
you.
Right. You're fine.
And you look like an idiot. That happens all the time to alcoholics. And I think that's like a full blown panic attack, a full blown anxiety attack. And I'm really, really grateful. I've only had two of them and I never want to have another one.
I you know, and it is, you said it's part of fear, but it's a different animal, isn't it? Than like the fear of spiders or the fear of, oh my gosh, I'm going to have to be sober the rest of my life or something like that. It's a little different.
It's you know, it's more corrosive. Like if you're walking through the Rocky Mountains and all of a sudden you walk up on a rattlesnake, I mean, you're going to have appropriate fear.
Yeah.
If you're walking really close to the edge of a cliff, and you're going to have appropriate fear, right? Mm-hmm. What happens is we have inappropriate fear. We're afraid to go to work.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I don't really feel like going to work today. I think I'm sick. Mm-hmm. You know, that's anxiety, and it blocks us off from being where we need to be, doing what we need to be doing.
Yeah.
And I think that revolves around, hopefully Bill say something about that as we start to get into this article.
All right.
So let's see what the spiritual master Bill Wilson has to say about it.
Indeed.
Okay.
Indeed.
As the AA Big Book says, fear is an evil and corroding thread. The fabric of our lives is shot through with it. Fear is surely a bar to reason and to love. And of course, it invariably powers anger, vulgarity, and aggression.
Mm.
It underlies maudlin guilt and paralyzing depression. President Roosevelt once made the significant remark that we have nothing to fear but fear itself. It's an interesting paragraph.
Mm.
This is a severe indictment, and it is possibly too sweeping. For all its usual destructiveness, we have found that fear can be the starting point of better things. Fear can be a stepping stone to to prudence and to a decent respect for others. It can point the path to justice as well as to hate. And the more we have of respect and justice, the more we shall begin to find the love which can suffer much and yet be freely given. So fear need not always be destructive, because the lessons of it, of its consequences, can lead us to positive values. That's an interesting position to take at the beginning of this article.
Yeah, makes me reflect on my first sponsor. I remember him telling me that there was healthy fear. And that's what he's saying. It's interesting. Fear can be the starting point for better things.
Yeah, like making better decisions,
right?
And things like that, right? You know,
well, you would think if you're driving down the street and you got a bottle of Jack Daniels between your legs, and all of a sudden you see the blue and red lights flashing, you know, you go into, I'm speaking from experience now, you go into panic mode and you think, that's it, I'm going to jail, I just am. You know, and all of a sudden the guy goes around you and speeds off because he's actually on a way to another call. You would think, okay, that's it, I'm going home. But no.
No.
So it
I
didn't,
got lucky.
It didn't scare me enough. You know, do you think there's a difference between being scared and having fear?
You know, alcoholics get offered the same opportunity to learn a lesson over and over and over and over again. So I, you know, fear is great. Yeah, fear is probably what Bill Wilson is saying here, but I haven't found it an adequate defense against, you know, being a horse's patoot sometimes,
right.
You know what I mean?
Right. Right.
Anyway, let's see what we got here. The achievement of freedom from fear is a lifetime undertaking. One that can never be wholly completed. When under heavy attack, acute illness, or in other conditions of serious insecurity, we shall all react, well or badly as the case may be. Only the vainglorious claim perfect freedom from fear, though their very grandiosity is really rooted in the fear that they have temporarily forgotten. Therefore, the problem of resolving fear has two aspects. We shall have to try for all the freedom from fear that is possible for us to attain. Then we shall need to find both the courage and the grace to deal constructively with whatever fear remains. Trying to understand our fears and the fears of others is but the first step. The larger question is how and where we go from there. You know, my evolution with this, Monty, was, I almost stopped going to 12-step meetings because I found it so uncomfortable to drive to the meeting, get out of the car, walk down into the basement, pretend I'm not, you know, freaked out.
Yeah.
And that was anxiety and that was fear. And there was a lot of it that was resolved from the step work. A lot of it was resolved from 9-step amends, right? A lot of my fear. And I grew much more comfortable with myself and my environment. But there are still things. There are still things that that really continue to need work. Procrastination. You know, there's still some things in my life that, there's opportunity. Let's just put it that way. You know, and so Bill is right. You know, we're never going to be fully cured of this thing called fear, but it can be reduced so that we can, you know, accomplish great things in our lives. You know, things that we couldn't accomplish when we, dodged and weaved and always, you know, pulled a no-show.
When you were going through your early meeting attendance and you had those fears and so forth, would you credit your sponsor to a lot of the help that he gave you to walk through some of that?
Yes.
Yeah.
Because the one thing he told me when I first showed up was, Chris, you're damaged. I'm only going to tell you one thing because I don't want you to become confused. So here's the one thing I'm going to tell you. I want to see you in a meeting every night until I tell you to stop. And Monty, I took it as a piece of business. I took it as if I miss a meeting, I could die. I mean, that's how much of a piece of business I took it as. And so, yes, he forced me because I was more afraid of letting him down and getting drunk than I was of going to the meetings.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So the answer to that is yes.
And the reason I asked that question is because when you described the anxiety that you were having early on going to meetings, I see that in a lot of people who attend but don't participate, if that makes sense.
Yep, yep.
And so they attend, and then the anxiety, they just rather not go. So then they don't go, and we don't see them again.
You know, in the 90s, it was, why aren't you sharing? You know, why don't you share at meetings?
Yeah.
Oh, I talk to my sponsor. I don't really have a lot to say. And a lot of times the people that weren't sharing weren't staying.
You know,
I'm talking strictly fellowship, this was prior to anybody understanding the urgency of the 12 steps.
Sure.
Because AA in the early 90s in my area, steps were you go to 12 step and 12 tradition meetings and share about the steps. What you did. You listen to them, you shared about them, you philosophized about them, you read them, you just didn't do them.
Yeah.
And that was the early 90s in my area. Mm-hmm. So once I became convinced by some big book aficionados, mm-hmm. I started to see the importance of it as a way of life, as something you had to do. You had to spend the time doing it, instead of like reading about it, Since AA's beginning, I have watched as thousands of my fellows became more and more able to understand and to transcend their fears. These examples have been unfailing help and inspiration. Perhaps then some of my own experiences with fear and the shedding of it to an encouraging degree may be appropriate. As a child, I had some pretty heavy emotional shocks. There was a dear family, a deep family disturbance. I was physically awkward and the like. Of course, other kids have such emotional handicaps and emerge unscathed, but I didn't. Evidently, I was oversensitive and therefore over-scared. Anyhow, I developed a positive phobia that I wasn't like other youngsters and never could be. At first, this threw me into depression and thence into the isolation of retreat. I can identify with that whole thing.
Me too.
Now,
me
Monty,
too.
Here's what happened to Bill. And you don't see this in Bill's story or, you know, but this is what happened to Bill. He is a kid. And him and his sister are living with the mother and father. And one day the father comes in and says, the marble has run out in the quarry. I'm going to Canada. I'm going to Canada to cut marble. That's where you have to go.
Mm-hmm.
And he left. I mean, literally, that was back in the day where you're not coming back. I mean, you traveled by train. It would take like a week to get there and a week to get back. You're not coming back on on the red eye. So his father was gone. The next day, his mother walks in and said, I'm going to New York City. I'm going to become a medical doctor, and you're going to stay with your grandfather here at the Wilson House. And she left. So within 2 days, both of his parents were gone.
Wow.
Now I had one of my parents, I'm 3 days into my 12th birthday, and my mother walks in and said, they just called me from the company, and your father died in the bathroom, you know, today at work. And the damage that did to me, I'm still discovering, Monty.
Wow.
You know what I mean? Because I'm 12, right? How would you like both of your parents within a 2-day period of time to say goodbye to you? And that's really what they did. I mean, it's not like he never saw them again, but they were out of the picture and he was with the grandfather. So I can see a lot of this stuff happening to him. You know what I mean?
And then a lot of his views about spiritual matters was tainted by his grandfather. True.
His grandfather was a beautiful agnostic until one day he took his bottle of moonshine or whatever the hell he had. He ran a bar and climbed up a mountain. He was just, I'm leaving. I'm going to go get drunk up on the mountain. And something happened on that mountain, Monty. And he came back down off of that mountain, and there's a church right next to the Wilson House. There was a congregation in there doing their thing, and he busted in there, and he pushed the preacher away from the lectern, and he started to talk about Jesus. He had had an experience up on that mountain.
Wow.
Yeah, that's Bill Wilson's grandfather.
Wow.
You know, so some wacky stuff was going on in this guy's family.
Wow. You know what I mean? Wow. What a trip. How old was Bill when that happened? Do you know?
You know, I don't know. I don't know. But I have a feeling he was still around.
Yeah.
You know, so he hadn't gone into the army yet.
Right.
So he had the agnostic and he had the evangelical had an experienced grandfather, which could have been confusing too, you know, for a young kid. But a lot of this stuff is going on. And here's another thing: his first girlfriend. He had a girlfriend that he was totally in love with in high school, and one day the teacher came in and said. I forget her name, Linda Lou or something. We need to make an announcement to the entire student body that Linda Lou went into the hospital last night and she died. And so he lost his first girlfriend. Mm-hmm. So there was a ton of what you would describe today as traumatic loss.
Trauma, in
his early life, you know.
My goodness.
So some of that stuff probably colors what he's talking about, but I get it. I know exactly what he's talking about in these paragraphs.
Wow.
But these child miseries, all of them generated by fear, became so unbearable that I turned highly aggressive. And that was me too. I was a little criminal. Thinking I never could be long and vowing I'd never settle for any second-rate status. I felt I simply had to dominate in everything I chose to do, work or play. As this attractive formula for the good life began to succeed according to my then specifications of success, I became deliriously happy. But when an undertaking occasionally did fail, I was filled with a resentment and a depression that could be cured only by the next triumph. Very early, therefore, I came to value everything in the terms of victory or defeat, all or nothing. The only satisfaction I knew was to win. So the only thing that I can relate to in this is right around the time my father died, I started riding many bikes. Many bikes, went to the smaller motorcycles. Smaller motorcycles went to really big motorcycles. And by the time I was 16 years old, I was racing 400cc Mako motocross bikes in motocross races. Mm. And Monty, I had to be the best on that motocross bike. Nowhere else. But I had to.
Wow.
It was very important. It was very important for me not to get beaten. You know, by a faster rider.
Oh, my goodness.
And, so I relate a little bit to that. This was my false antidote for fear, and this was the pattern, ever more deeply etched, that dogged me through school days. World War One, the hectic drinking career on Wall Street, and down into the final hours of my complete collapse. At that time, adversity was no longer a stimulant, and I knew not whether my greater fear was to live or to die. And I got to that point, around 1987, Monty. I had a 38 caliber handgun. I don't even know where the hell I had gotten it, and I would put it up to my head almost every night, and just cuss myself for a weakling that I wouldn't pull the trigger. I was scared of living. I was scared of dying. I had anxiety about living. I had anxiety about dying. And I get it.
Wow.
While my basic fear pattern is a very common one, there are, of course, many others. Indeed, fear manifestations and the problems that trail in their wake are so numerous and complex that this brief article, it is not possible to detail even a few of them. We can only review those spiritual resources and principles by which we may be able to face and deal with fear in any of its aspects. This is what I like about Bill. He is not going to write a 600-page book on the multifaceted forms of fear and anxiety. He's going to cut right to the chase. How can you escape it?
Hmm. Yeah.
You know what I mean? What do you need to, the ass is in the ditch. Let's just concentrate on how we get it out of there. Let's not worry about how it got in there. Whose fault it is that it got in there. Let's put all of our energy into getting it out.
And that seems to be a pattern with so many people. When I've counseled guys in treatment, for instance, and they feel the need to fillet themselves open to a degree where everything, including the color of the paint on the walls where they grew up, was part of the story. I mean, everything. And it's a challenge to reel them in and let's get to the solution. How long do you want to be sick? You know what I mean?
I can't believe you're saying that because I'm dealing with somebody right now that I love more than life itself. One of my favorite men in the world, and he went through a horrific relapse. And while he was relapsing, he was with, a high priced, well-meaning psychiatrist in a big city. Mm. Who really wanted to work him through all of his shame and issues, and he got really caught up. He got really caught up in the discovery process.
Wow.
Not the recovery process.
Yeah.
Because a lot of times psychiatrists, they'll help you uncover and discover things. Only the best are going to help you discard them.
Yes.
So he's in his third treatment center now, and he's still convinced that he's dealing with shame. Something that today I could deal with in 5 minutes.
Yeah,
Monty.
Amen.
You
amen.
Know what I mean?
Yep. Yep.
Now, I would not have to ruin my family. You know what I mean? Yeah. I would be able to deal with it in 5 minutes because I deal with it in the 12-step world, which is about. About discarding these things.
And that's where, I love the whole came to believe recovery thought. They call 10, 11, and 12 living in the go, right? Are you living in the go? Do you live in 10, 11, and 12? Do you have to do a four step every other week for crying out? You never have to do another four step. If you're living in 10, 11, and 12, then you, like you said, you're applying these principles in all your affairs. You're going to bed at night. You're asking for clarity of areas that you've been a knucklehead. The next day, you're asking God to keep you from those things, and then you're carrying this message of hope to other people. I don't. It's so simple, Chris.
It's almost too simple.
It's almost too
complicated because we have dark, complicated, artistic personalities. Mm. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That can't just be it. You know, my problems are different. My problems are different than yours. You know,
right.
Thinking that things are much deeper than they really are.
I've been drinking for 24 years. It's going to take me 24 years to recover. Well, yeah, I believe you.
I'm going to do a step every 24 years.
I believe you.
So what you said about 10 and 11 and 12, I totally believe today. I believe if you've made AA a way of life, you are active in step 10 and you are active in step 11 and you are active in step 12. And when you're doing that, you do not need to go back and redo anything,
right?
Because it's a way of life. There were periods of time when I had to do annual or biannual runs through the steps. There were, but Monty, it was because I was not taking this thing as a way of life. Yes, I had grabbed pieces of it here and there, and I'd applied pieces of it here and there, but it wasn't my core operational methodology like it is today. So I haven't started on step one and gone through step nine in 10 years now. I don't think I'll need to.
If you gave a big book to somebody who had never been to a meeting ever, who had never experienced the steps, who never experienced this way of life, and you just took them through the big book, I suspect that a lot of the pitfalls that happened wouldn't happen. Because they wouldn't have experienced, meeting makers make it. And if you don't go to the meeting, you're going to get drunk. And all the stuff that we shoot at people, that's not even part of the directives.
Alcoholics Anonymous a long time ago opened up the barn doors really wide. When I first came in, Monty, there was as many drug addicts as there were alcoholics in mm-hmm. the meetings. There just was, and everybody was pretending to be an alcoholic, and AA was fine with that, right? You know what I mean? Like unity. Put out another pamphlet. Put out a pamphlet for cross-dressing Eskimos. You know, who gamble, you know, because we might miss those guys. Put out a pamphlet quick. I mean, AA was about quantity. And here's the thing. What happened with all that was there were a lot of people who had not gone down the scale very far, and they could do the Bob Newhart AA.
Yeah.
They could do the sit around the circle and share crazy stuff. You know what I mean? And stay sober because they weren't what you would call the real alcoholic.
Yeah.
And long ago, Alcoholics Anonymous really started to see real alcoholism as something that is really not politically correct in the meetings anymore.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you showed up here tonight, you belong here. It was more of the party line, right? But so you have a palette of recovery experience out there in the fellowship, and some of it would never keep me sober, and some of it would keep a lot of people sober, and I'm okay with the whole thing. I think if you and I, Monty, are doing our job as 12 steppers, we're going to recognize the people who are in real trouble, who are really up against alcoholism,
yeah.
And we're gonna be in their face one way or another. It might be on our recordings, you know, but we're gonna be in their face, and we're gonna be telling them the truth.
Yeah.
And they'll find out that they can't you know, it's not a great life answer just to go to the Sunday men's meeting somewhere,
yeah,
and try to outshare everybody. They're going to find that that really isn't, you know, the right path for them. And listen, if one person who I wouldn't consider an alcoholic more than the man in the moon goes to meetings and stays sober and stays off the road, you know, when they're drinking.
Yeah.
You know, they're not drunk, drinking and driving anymore. I'm cool with it.
Hallelujah.
All,
you know you what bet.
I mean? I am cool with it. Yeah. Have your, you know, have your little, you know, men's meeting over there, you know, or your women's meeting over there, and, you know, do it your way, you know. But thank God there's the book Alcoholics Anonymous, where, you know, it's our foundational literature, and it is sufficient for the low bottom alcoholic.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, there's an answer even for the low bottom alcoholic still in Alcoholics Anonymous, even with all the damage that everyone's tried to do, you know, there's still hope for the real alcoholic.
Thank
you know
God.
What I mean? In my own case, the foundation stone of freedom from fear is that a faith that, despite all worldly appearances to the contrary, causes me to believe that I live in a universe that makes sense. To me, this means a belief in a creator who is all power, justice, and love. A God who intends for me a purpose, a meaning, and a destiny to grow, however little and haltingly, toward his own likeness and image. Before the coming of faith, I had lived as an alien in a cosmos that too often seemed both hostile and cruel. It is there, in it, there could be no inner security for me. This is something I really respond to too. Monty, every spiritual master on the planet gets to the end of their lessons, and the end of their lessons is this: all is well.
All is
well. And that's because of this deep faith,
yes,
in the goodness of God. And in this paragraph, Monty, he gives us a description of his particular description and understanding of God that's better than anything I've ever read before.
Yeah, this is excellent.
It's very personal.
I'm highlighting this. This would be a great piece to read in a meeting.
Have a show. Bill's conception of God,
yeah. Right.
And he's wise to pull pieces of specific religion or terminology that's specific to certain religions out of it, because the barn doors have to be pretty wide open.
Sure.
You know, like almost any religion, you know, you could agree to all this. So that's kind of cool too. Anyway, Dr. Carl Jung, one of the three founders of modern day depth psychology, had a profound conviction upon this great dilemma of the world today. In paraphrase, this is what he had to say about it. Any person who has reached 40 years of age, who still has no means of comprehending who he is, where he is, or where he is next going, cannot avoid becoming a neurotic to some degree or other. This is true whether his youthful drives for sex, material security, and a place in society have been satisfied or not satisfied. When the benign doctor said becoming neurotic, he might just as well have said becoming fear-ridden. This is exactly why we of AA place such emphasis on the need for faith in a higher power. Define that as we may. We have to find a life in the world of grace and spirit, and this is certainly a new dimension for most of us. Surprisingly, our quest for this realm of being is not too difficult. Our conscious entry into it usually begins as soon as we have deeply confessed our personal powerlessness to go on alone and have made our appeal to whatever God we think there is or may be. The gift of faith and the consciousness of a higher power is the outcome. As faith grows, so does inner security. The vast underlying fear of nothingness commences to subside. Therefore, we of AA find that our basic antidote for fear is a spiritual awakening.
Yes.
And it absolutely was for me.
Yes, me too. Me too. People ask me, you know, why aren't you worried? Aren't you? I mean, for instance, the state of the nation, the state of the world. No, I'm not. I'm not. I can yell at the TV just like anybody else. I can say, oh, my gosh, what is going on? People, you've lost your mind. I mean, all sorts of things have become normalized that are unhealthy, and I can look at that and go, I don't get it, or whatever. But when it's time to go to bed and lay my head down on my pillow, Chris, I don't have a care in the world. I just don't.
Yeah. Yeah. All is well.
Yeah.
Listen, I watch a lot of news, too, and I'm very interested in it. But does it, like, disturb me?
Ruin your day?
No. It's like a sociology course or something, you know? It's interesting to me because I'm at a point now where 90% of the time, Monty, all is well.
Sure.
And my sponsor, Cowboy Brad, I don't know if you've ever met him. He's out in Santa Monica. He's got me working on something. You know what he has me working on?
What's that?
Not worrying about anything that's not happening. Now, think about that. Think about that. If it's not happening, I'm not allowed to worry about it.
Right. Right. So there's no there's no atom bombs going off. So I'm not going to worry about that.
Right.
There's nobody breaking into my house. So I'm not going to worry about that.
It looks irresponsible, but that doesn't mean I don't plan and I don't do predictive maintenance on my car, and I don't ensure that I've got money to pay my bills. I do all that. I'm trying just not to worry about it if it's not happening. Yeah. What's happening right now is I'm on a show with Monty.
Right.
And I'm allowed to worry about that. Because it's happening.
Yeah, but we're having too much fun to worry about it. So
yeah, that's true. All is well on this podcast.
Yeah, that's great.
It so happens that my own spiritual perception was electrically sudden and absolutely convincing. At once, I became a part, if only a tiny part, of a cosmos that was ruled by justice and love and the person of God. No matter what had been the consequences of my own willfulness and ignorance, or those of my fellow travelers on earth, this was still the truth. Such was the new and positive assurance, and this has never left me. I was given to know, at least for the time being, what the absence of fear could be like. Of course, my own guilt of faith is not essentially different. My own gift of faith is not essentially different from those spiritual awakenings since received by countless AAs. It was only more sudden. But even this new frame of reference, critically important though it was, only marked my entrance into that long path which leads away from fear and toward love. The old and dearly carved etchings of anxiety were not instantly and permanently rubbed out. Of course, they reappeared, and sometimes alarmingly. Being the recipient of such a spectacular spiritual experience, it was not surprising that the first phase of my AA life was characterized by a great deal of pride and power driving. The craving for influence and approval, the desire to be the leader, was still very much with me. Better still, the behavior could now be justified, all in the name of good works.
Mm-hmm.
It fortunately turned out that this was rather blatant phase of my grandiosity, which lasted some years, was followed by a string of adversities. My demands for approval, which were obviously based on the fear that I might not get enough of it, began to collide with these identical traits in my fellow AAs. Hence, their saving of the fellowship from me, and I saving it from them, became an all-absorbing occupation. This, of course, resulted in anger, suspicion, all sorts of frightening episodes, and this remarkable and now rather amusing era of our affairs. Any number of us commenced playing God all over again. For some years, AA power drivers ran hog wild. But out of this fearsome situation, the 12 steps and the 12 traditions of AA were formulated. Mainly, these were principles designed for ego reduction and therefore for the reduction of our fears. These were the principles which we hoped would hold us in unity and increasing love for each other and for God. And really, this is what Bill is probably more respected for by non-alcoholics than anything else, architecting the 12 steps and the 12 traditions, because they can be applied in so many different ways. You know what I mean? By so many different people in so many different situations.
You know, Chris, what he just said here, it's real interesting. All the people that I've ever heard that are critical of Bill, they like to throw him under the bus and call him names and a shyster and all this kind of stuff. He isn't denying any of that. He just told on himself.
Yeah.
He just was just totally transparent. Yeah, I was power hungry. I wanted to be in charge. I wanted to be the guy. I wanted to be. Yeah, what's your point?
So his position was always this: you're trying to knock me off of a pedestal I never placed myself on.
Yeah. Yeah, you did that. You
know,
put me
you know
over
what
there.
I mean?
Right. Well, I tell my sponsees this. Look, if you ever get to a point where you have the audacity to put me on a pedestal, at least have enough grace to forgive me when I fall off, because I'm going to fall off. In fact, I may jump off.
Oh, my God. Me too.
Yeah.
Gradually, we began to be able to accept the other fellow's sins as well as his virtues. It was in this period that we coined the potent and meaningful expression, "Let us always love the best in others and never fear their worst." After some 10 years of trying to work this brand of love and the ego-reducing properties of the AA steps and traditions into the life of our society, the awful fears for the survival of AA simply vanished. The practice of AA's 12 steps and 12 traditions in our personal lives also brought incredible releases from fear of every description, despite the wide prevalence of formidable personal problems. When fear did persist, we knew it for what it was, and under God's grace, we became able to handle it. We began to see each adversity as a God-given opportunity to develop the kind of courage which is born of humility rather than of bravado. Thus, we were enabled to accept ourselves, our circumstances, and our fellows. Under God's grace, we even found that we could die with decency, dignity, and faith, knowing that the Father doeth the works. All right, Monty, I have some experience with this. I work in a hospice. A lot of times, people come into the hospice who are in long-term recovery. I know because I talk to them, and I will tell you, we die great deaths.
Mm.
We do. We are at peace.
Yeah.
We've made all of our amends. We have told our family members what they need to be told. And we slip off into the next room to meet our Creator.
Mm.
And we do it with dignity. And I know that because I see that.
Wow. That's a great testament to the this whole thing. It really is.
And there are people who do not go gently into that dark night. They fight and they thrash and they swear and those are people with all the unresolved stuff. All the unresolved stuff that these 12 steps help us resolve.
I had a friend who was a pastor years ago who shared with me that he was sitting next to a gentleman who was in the process of passing away, and the guy would just kick against the goads when it came to God. I mean, he just always did, you know, but he always asked for the pastor to come visit him. And so he asked him, he says, do you now believe in God? He goes, absolutely. Do you now want to accept God into your life? Absolutely not. And then he passed away.
Yeah.
That to me, that just breaks my heart, you know. But like you said, there are scores of people that move on, and it's a celebration. It's not just a celebration of their life, it's a celebration of the new realm they're about to enter.
So 3/4 of the time, you know what their last words are?
Mm.
I'm going home.
I'm going home, yeah.
Yeah. I'm not kidding.
Yeah,
you know,
I believe
it. Talk to any hospice nurse.
I believe it. I believe it. Wow.
Aid. That's what they'll tell you.
Wow. All
right. Because there's a realization. There's an experience that you start to have.
Mm.
And you start to see and you start to experience some things. And that's what they say. Mm. You know what I mean?
Wow.
I believe that stuff now more than ever because I see it.
Oh, yeah.
All right. We of AA now find ourselves living in a world characterized by destructive fears as never before in history. But in it, we nevertheless see great areas of faith and tremendous aspirations toward justice and brotherhood. Yet no prophet can presume to say whether the world outcome will be blazing destruction or the beginning, under God's intention, of the brightest era yet known to mankind. I am sure we AAs will comprehend this scene. In microcosm, we have experienced this identical state of terrifying uncertainty, each in his own life. In no sense, pridefully, we AAs can say that we do not fear the world outcome, which course it may take. This is because we have been able to feel and say, we shall fear no evil, thy will not ours be done.
Amen.
Isn't it, if you have fear, isn't it because self-reliance has failed you?
Yes.
You know, thy will, not mine be done. Mm. These are thoughts which must go with us constantly.
Constantly. Yeah.
Right, Monty?
Yep. Amen.
Often told, the following story can nevertheless bear repeating. On the day that the staggering calamity of Pearl Harbor fell upon our country, a friend of AA and one of the greatest spiritual figures that we may ever know was walking along a street in St. Louis. This was, of course, our well-loved Father Ed Dowling of the Jesuit Order. Though not an alcoholic, he had been one of the founders and a prime inspiration of the struggling AA group in this city. Because large numbers of his usually sober friends had already taken to their bottles, that they might blot out the implications of the Pearl Harbor disaster, Father Ed was understandably anguished by the probability that his cherished AA group would scarcely settle for less. To Father Ed's mind, this would be a first-class calamity all of itself. Then an AA member, sober less than a year, stepped alongside, engaged Father Ed in a spiritual conversation, mostly about AA. As Father Ed saw with relief, his companion was perfectly sober, and not a word did he volunteer about the Pearl Harbor business. Wondering happily about this, the good father queried, "How is it that you have nothing to say about Pearl Harbor? How can you roll with a punch like that?" "Well," replied the AA, "I'm really surprised that you don't know. Each and every one of us in AA has already had his own private Pearl Harbor. So I ask you, why should we alcoholics crack up over this?"
That's great.
Wow.
Wow.
Wow, 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 wow. Great. That was a really great article.
That was a great article.
That's Bill at his best, I think.
Oh, man, that bears reading again. That is really, really good. So, listeners, here's what I really encourage you. If this is the first time you've ever tuned into this or gone through a book like this, Isn't it just heartwarming? I mean, it is to me. I mean, you know me. I am so much into learning more and more about the history of this fellowship and the people in it and the founders. I don't know. There's something about when I alluded to it earlier, when you go from attendee to participant. You know, there's something about it. Your life changes. It is fulfilling. It is rich. You don't want to miss it, listeners. You really, really don't. Which leads me into the segue of, if you want to catch up on all these shows of Walking Through the Language of the Heart, visit us at take12radio.com. I'll be repeating it at the end of the show, and it'll tell you how you can catch up on all these shows and download them for fun and for free. Chris, thanks again, buddy.
Monty, it is always a pleasure. What a great opportunity this is. I'm super grateful.
Yeah, me too. Me too. All right, my friends. Well, until next time, this is the Monty Man along with Chris and the rest of the Take 12 Recovery Radio family. And we are wishing God's perfect serenity for you. For more recovery workshops with Chris S. and the Monty Man, visit our website at take12radio.com and click on the Recovery Workshops banner.
has been a broadcast of Take 12 Recovery Radio and KHLT Recovery Broadcasting.
This has been a Chicken and a Pig production.
Kitty, 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 kitty. Meow, meow, meow.
Woof, woof.